You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or subscribe to Brookings Podcasts through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. You can also follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Many, many thanks, especially to all of you who have traveled far and wide to join us. Greetings to the many people who are joining us on webcast. I think we have hundreds and hundreds around the world. So thanks to all of you for joining us, too. It's a real pleasure to be here with my friend and colleague, Emiliana Vegas. We are co-hosting this year our annual Center's Policy and Research Forum with the IEDB's Regional Dialogue, and it's a real pleasure. So thanks to your team for being such great collaborators.
Thank you, everybody. As Rebecca said, I'm Emiliana Vegas. I have the honor of leading the Education Division at the Inter-American Development Bank, where we support countries in Latin America and the Caribbean to help achieve learning and skills among all its youth to help the region reach its full potential. We are especially pleased to welcome ministers and authorities of education from Latin America and the Caribbean who are here today to join us, education innovators from all over the world, funders, policymakers, and practitioners to explore the promise of leapfrogging in education. Please note that there are headsets for simultaneous translation below your seats if you should need them. Por favor, encuentren sus audífonos debajo de sus asientos.
You can find your headsets under your seats for those of you who need it, and then you can follow simultaneous interpretation channel 2 English, channel 10 Spanish, and you simply click on the arrow.
To take to social media and to carry on the conversation in English and Spanish with the following hashtag.
Pound.
Pound future edu. Hashtag. Number sign. Today's symposium is focused on the citizens of the future, innovations to leapfrog global education. This topic is especially important to us at the IEADB because we are the region that has achieved the fastest growing rates in enrollment, but yet our children and our students are not getting the skills they need to succeed. In all the international assessments of student learning, Latin American students are in the bottom end of the distribution. So we want to learn from innovations that can help our region make this jump and not follow the normal trajectory, because if we continue in the path we've been, we'll really never reach the levels of learning that we need to advance. This is also a very unusual event. You'll have the chance to listen to experts, ask them incisive questions, to be listened, and even to experiment and interact with innovators. We encourage your active participation and invite you to collectively reflect on the next steps to strengthen and make grow the community of innovators of all kinds. Because when we talk about innovation, we do not just talk about technology. We speak of a creative way to face challenges with which educational systems and teachers have dealt with for years, and also the new challenges to come. And we also speak of opening ourselves to alliances and collaboration among different stakeholders, different sectors, to ensure that every young person develops the set of skills they need to be successful and reach their full potential. We are very happy to work with the Center for Universal Education at Brookings. CUE also cares deeply about this topic, has been leading the research agenda led by Rebecca here on leapfrogging in education, and this symposium serves as the launch of their book, Leapfrogging Inequality, Remaking Education to Help Young People Thrive. In this first session, we will have several remarks on this topic to get the discussion going and then have a discussion together.
Thank you, Miliana. I want to introduce our first speaker, Valerie Smith, who is president of Swarthmore College. You will have her full, long, distinguished biography in your program, in your packet. She's a noted scholar on African-American literature, and she was at UCLA and at Princeton prior to coming to Swarthmore. But that's not why we asked you, Val. Why we asked you to come speak is because Swarthmore College, for many of you who may not have heard of it, I'm sure everyone in the room will love it after you speak, but not necessarily everyone around the globe has heard of Swarthmore College. It's not only my alma mater, but it is a liberal arts college. Not many places around the world have liberal arts education. It's often higher education is much more technical or specialized. And Val and Swarthmore College has thought a lot about what types of competencies and skills and learning environment is necessary to educate leaders for the common good. And we really thought that insight and what she can share with us, having thought long and hard about this, is helpful for framing the debate today about what could and should citizens of the future look like and how should we think about educating them. And so with that, Val, please welcome to the stage.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you so much, Rebecca, for inviting me to be here today. I'm honored to be able to address this distinguished body of ministers and authorities of education from Latin America and the Caribbean, education innovators, funders, policymakers, and practitioners. As the product of a liberal arts institution, and someone who has spent her entire career as a professor in liberal arts institutions and now president of a liberal arts college, I've had many opportunities to think about the goals and the values of liberal arts education. Today, I'd like to speak for a few moments about some of the ways I believe liberal arts institutions prepare students for life. First and most significantly, liberal arts colleges and universities have as their primary mission the goal of teaching students to think and to think critically in preparation for an uncertain world. In that regard, they differ from more career-focused higher education models. No other type of institution so effectively prepares students to distinguish fact from fiction, valid arguments from specious claims. We teach students to think critically, to write and to speak persuasively, to solve problems, and to work collaboratively with others. Contrary to all too common assertions, employers across a wide range of areas, finance, engineering, business, public service, media, and healthcare, to name only a few, are eager to hire graduates of liberal arts institutions precisely because they possess these talents and abilities. Equally important is the gift of developing the lifelong habit of intellectual engagement. As Fareed Zakaria has written, and I quote, "Because of the times we live in, all of us, young and old, do not spend enough time and effort thinking about the meaning of life. We do not look inside ourselves enough to understand our strengths and weaknesses, and we do not look around enough at the world, in history, to ask the deepest and broadest questions. The solution surely is that, even now, we could all use a little bit more of a liberal education. When we do our jobs correctly, our students graduate with a love of learning and a sophisticated understanding of how they learn, that enables them to appreciate art, music, and dance, and to assess arguments about the fundamental claims of scientific discovery, political propaganda, or economic models. Secondly, our institutions prepare students for the unexpected, for life's unanticipated disappointments, developments, and opportunities. In contrast to the linearity of the vocational or technical educational models, liberal arts institutions offer students a less targeted, more expansive preparation. We proceed from the assumption that students are better served by being introduced to a broad range of disciplines before selecting a specific area of concentration. We push them beyond their zones of comfort and require them to gain some familiarity with multiple ways of knowing. At a liberal arts institution, a student who wants to study economics to prepare for a career in business or finance, for example, would also be required to take courses in the humanities, in the creative and performing arts, and in the natural sciences. This approach expands the student's intellectual horizons and deepens their preparation for the vocation they might ultimately choose. It equips them to adapt to the uncertainties of life and work they will inevitably confront. Now, I make this claim with confidence because I've met individuals who have shared with me how their broad liberal arts education has enhanced their skills in their chosen profession and enabled them to seize new opportunities. Take, for example, the lawyer turned educator turned entrepreneur, or the investor turned musician, or the engineer who founded a liberal arts college. All of these people attribute their ability to seize new opportunities to the intellectual self-confidence their education gave them. Their education taught them how they learn and reassured them that they could learn what it would take to meet life's new challenges. And the third goal of a residential liberal arts institution, and this is the one on which I'd like to spend the most time this morning in my remarks, the third goal of a residential liberal arts institution is to help students develop into productive and responsible citizens. They acquire lessons relevant to this goal, both within and outside the classroom. In a club, they might learn how to become a project manager, to lead a team, to manage a budget. In the residence hall, they meet lifelong friends and learn to negotiate differences in personalities, values, and living habits. These co-curricular interactions often provide opportunities for personal, intellectual, and ethical growth that may be as significant as the lessons they learn in the classroom. I want to take a few moments to tell you today about a program at Swarthmore College that exists at the intersection of the curriculum and co-curricular activities and exemplifies how the liberal arts helps to form the citizens of the future. Students in our President's Sustainability Research Fellows Program are learning to use the resources of a liberal arts education to contribute to the common good, especially in the area of sustainability. This innovative program matches 12 students a year with staff, faculty, neighbors, or alumni mentors who help them identify a campus or a local sustainability challenge, and to research, develop, and implement a project in response to that challenge. The students commit to a year-long academic course with an associated internship. During that year, they learn to bring about change in a large organization, and they gain invaluable experience with project management, communications, and advocacy. Redesigning the college's waste management system, implementing a campus carbon charge, developing greater energy efficiency in the design and construction of new buildings. These are but a few of the initiatives that our students have undertaken. Through this program, they learn to take responsibility for the community in which they live, to use their academic talents to solve persistent problems, to work collaboratively with others, and to communicate the importance of their solutions to audiences of specialists and non-specialists alike. One student, whose name is Sasha, is a Spanish major from California. And this year, she worked with administrative and facilities maintenance staff to design a more efficient waste management system in one of our administrative buildings. Now, we've set a college-wide waste diversion goal of 80% by 2022. Campus-wide, we are now at approximately 40%. Sasha's work moved the building to which she was assigned to 64%, not bad for 1 year's worth of work. But the success of her work can be measured beyond this waste diversion goal. As Sasha describes her project, one can tell that she is especially intrigued by the unanticipated lessons she learned. Her work taught her the value of building and sustaining community. As she put the waste diversion project in place, she forged meaningful relationships with maintenance and administrative staff, and she also helped these employees from different areas of campus forge meaningful relationships with each other. In turn, these results have prompted her to reflect about how the amount of time we spend doing work relates to our goals for sustainability. To what extent, she asks, do our workplaces, and I quote, demand so much from people that we have created a system that forces us to sacrifice stronger social relationships, health, and the environment for our work, end of quote. Her ability to peel back the layers of her project, to turn it, and to come at its key questions from different perspectives is a mark of the liberal arts mind at work. So through this program, she's learning project management, collaboration, effective communication. But she's also developing an openness of mind that will allow her to seek out and receive the unanticipated lessons that life has to teach. Many leading liberal arts institutions have expressed a commitment to both recruit an increasingly diverse population of students, faculty, and staff, and to cultivate more inclusive communities. This commitment also helps us prepare students for lives as productive citizens. We recognize that higher education is an engine of social mobility that has the capacity to improve the life chances of individuals from less affluent backgrounds. To achieve the excellence to which we aspire, we recognize that we must seek and recruit talent from across the nation and the globe and from every socioeconomic group. But perhaps even more important, at a time when our local and global communities are all too fractured by racial, ethnic, socioeconomic, and religious differences, and when people from opposing ends of the political spectrum seem increasingly unable to communicate across their differences, residential liberal arts institutions provide students with rare opportunities to work, play, and live in communities with people different from themselves. This is a meaningful opportunity, especially in the United States, because across our country, communities and school districts remain strikingly segregated. But as we've come to recognize, diversity is just the first step. We must do more than open the doors of access to our institutions. Indeed, we must do more than ensure that all students have access to the range of opportunities we provide. If we want to build truly diverse and inclusive communities, and if we want to prepare students to build, sustain, live, and work in inclusive and diverse communities, then we must also provide them with the tools to recognize their common humanity with people whose experiences and perspectives differ from their own. That means that even as we empower them to speak their truths, to give voice to those whose voices have been traditionally silenced, they must also embrace the value of empathy and humility, to be able to acknowledge the humanity of those with whom they disagree or those they do not understand. That means being able to stay in difficult conversations with those whose views differ from their own, to speak for themselves while learning also to hear the other side. A liberal arts education is valuable then because it teaches students to think critically, prepares them to adapt to change, and empowers them to collaborate effectively at work and in their communities. These life skills are not easily measured by conventional metrics, such as the salary earned at the first job after graduation. A more proper measure of a liberal arts education is how well it trains students to think critically, to be flexible and nimble when faced with unexpected circumstances or opportunities, to adapt to multiple career paths, and to interact productively in diverse communities. Those of us who have benefited from or who have dedicated our lives to teaching at liberal arts institutions must tell the powerful story of this educational model. In that way, others will see how a liberal arts education can transform the lives of those it touches and prepare them as citizens to solve the most persistent and complex challenges that face societies across the globe. Thank you.
By 2030, over half of the world's young people will reach adulthood without even the most basic high school level skills. But this doesn't even take into account the broad set of skills needed to thrive in a fast-changing world. How should education systems react? Traditionally, educational progress around the world has followed one linear path, and the pace of change is quite slow. Inspired by examples of rapid change in other sectors, we chart a new path forward for education, leapfrogging. This type of progress, though, requires us to look at new models of teaching and learning that complement what exists today. To explore the potential of today's innovations to support a global leap forward, we compiled a global catalogue of education innovations. We also created an evidence-based pathway to assess innovation's potential to support leapfrogging. Though gaps remain, we are hopeful that education innovations can play a meaningful role in ensuring all learners are equipped to thrive now and into the future.
Thank you. Thank you to the comms team. Now I don't need to give the talk. You got the synopsis of the book. So thank you, all of you, again for being here. And thanks, Val, for sort of charting out for us, you know, what might be a vision for developing citizens of the future. And what I want to switch now is to talk about some of the research we've been doing over the last 3 years, really trying to think about how would you do that? How would you transform education systems to make sure that all kids get that broad suite of competencies and capabilities that Val talked about? And this question on the screen is the question that we've been thinking a lot about. Is it possible to leapfrog in education? And what is the role of education innovations in particular to rapidly accelerate progress? We've been writing blogs and articles and reports, and we're very happy to share with you the culminating piece of the research is this book, Leapfrogging Inequality, which we are launching today. And I would be remiss without thanking many, many people who have participated in its development, including especially my co-authors, Adam Barton and Eileen McGivney. Before I dive in, and what I'm going to do is sort of walk you through some of the key questions that we asked ourselves in this research process to lead to this, that informed the book. But before I do that, I wanted to just poll the audience on a couple of questions. I'm going to put up 4 words on the screen, and I want you to just raise your hand. I'll list them one by one. I'll say them one by one. Just raise your hand if they resonate with you in terms of your perception of the education systems in your country or the countries you work in. I've begun to ask audiences in all the talks I give recently these questions. So we'll see how similar you are to the other folks I've asked. Okay, raise your hand if you think and feel that education systems are resistant to change. Just raise your hand high. Okay, there's like 3 holdouts. No, they're not resistant to change. Okay, raise your hand if you think education systems are cutting edge. Not one. Oh, this is worse than other audiences. There was always a couple of people. Okay, raise your hand if you think education systems are innovative. Yeah, a couple. The back of the room. This is where the optimistic people are in the back. Raise your hand if you think education systems are political. Yeah. So one of the reasons that this actually is very similar. You are a little bit more negative than most groups on the cutting edge piece, but that's okay. We will take heart. This is, you know, only a conference about education innovation and innovators in the room. Most groups that I you know talk to have similar feelings. And there is a narrative, I think a public narrative, certainly in this country and in many other countries, that education systems are just not innovative and they're hard to change. There was a magazine article in a popular U.S. magazine called Time Magazine a couple of years ago that said, for those of you who have read it, you know what I'm talking about. They said, you know, if you transported somebody from 1850 and brought them to today, to the world today, and they would walk into a hospital and they wouldn't recognize anything. They wouldn't recognize the transportation systems, but if you brought them to a school, they would immediately feel relaxed and familiar, and this is comfort. And things, basically the message was things haven't changed in 150 years, which I have to say, I read it, and I was at first quite defensive, and I said, well, they don't know what they're talking about. Education is different. Things have definitely changed. The population we're educating has massively changed. It's much more inclusive. And then I thought, okay, stop being defensive. What is it about other sectors that has this public narrative of transformation? And so the very first question we asked ourselves in this process was this one: what can we learn from other sectors? And we looked at a bunch of different sectors, and you can think of many examples. You know, if you think of the information sector, you can think of many examples of transformation. I like to think about sort of the days when I only used a physical encyclopedia to look up information. So, you know, physical encyclopedias to Wikipedia. And, you know, we asked ourselves, you know, would we know if we had a Wikipedia moment in education? Would we recognize it if it hit us? We looked at banking. I mean, we looked at telecommunications, landlines to mobile phones. We looked at banking. And I want to give you an example of how transformations in banking have really helped people's lives. There is a group of people in the world who focus on financial inclusion. And what they're very worried about is making sure that all people, particularly low-income and poor communities, have access to bank accounts, have access to credit. And the switch from building physical bank branches out in remote areas, which was one way to get access to bank accounts, to mobile banking, in the case of Kenya, and we have a Darius, Minister of Education here, from works in the ministry of from Kenya, will know what we're talking about, in 4 years doubled the amount of people who had access to bank accounts and access to credit. So a very swift time. The pace of change for financial inclusion was going slowly, then mobile banking, and it just shot up. And that idea, which we are calling leapfrogging, and others do call leapfrogging also, is the one that inspired us. And we define leapfrogging, and others do too, in other sectors, although in education there's not, hasn't been a defined concept of what education would, what leapfrogging would look like in education. So again, our inspiration from other sectors. Leapfrogging really defined as rapid, non-linear progress, jumping ahead, accelerating quickly, often bypassing old legacy infrastructure. Not always, but often. And at the core of leapfrogging in other sectors is innovation. Innovation in technology, innovation in how people work together, innovation in expectations. And so the next question we asked ourselves is this one: what can education innovations tell us about leapfrogging? And we defined an innovation as a idea or technology that breaks from previous practice and is new in a context, if not new to the world. And we spend a lot of time, and here I would say Adam and Eileen and many wonderful interns are to thank, scan the globe for education innovations, and really try to see what we could learn. And we relied heavily on organizations that we call innovation spotters. These are organizations who have either the whole or part of their mandate to search for, highlight, identify, highlight, and showcase and sometimes fund education innovations. And you'll be hearing from some of those organizations later in the day. So what did we find? Well, we developed, as you heard in the little video, a global catalog of education innovations with almost 3,000 education innovations in it from 166 countries. And you will see that education is happening everywhere. In fact, education is innovative. There's lots and lots and lots of innovation happening in education. The dark blue are where there's most innovations, and lighter blue countries is where there's least. And again, this is just a snapshot. This is by no means a comprehensive map of all the education innovations out there. And poor and rich countries alike are innovating. High-performing and low-performing education systems are innovating. It's as if people are searching for new ways to do things. And we would hope, in part, that's because of the need to develop citizens for the future, young people with the types of skills and competencies that Val talked about. So I always get asked when I tell people about this, well, what do you mean? What are they doing? What are these education innovations doing? So I'm going to give you five really quick snapshots of examples of education innovation, and then we'll talk more broadly about sort of how we think about leapfrogging. One is LIMA, which is the Literacy and Math Education Lab. I am purposely trying to pull from the many examples in Latin America, because we have many Latin American policymakers in the audience. This started in Colombia. And basically what it is a nonprofit who works in communities and leverages the resources, human resources that are inside communities, and leverages the many, many hours that young people are out of school. I have a colleague, Kathy Hirsch-Pasek, who works on this topic, thinking about how can you make out-of-school time support and complement the learning that's happening inside school. In the United States, but if a child between 0 and 18, 80% of their waking hours are outside this classroom. I would venture in the developing world, it's much higher because you have shorter school days in most countries. Almost 90% of time is outside the classroom, waking hours. And so this innovation did just that. It hires literacy coaches, could be an educated sibling, could be a community member, could be a parent, could be a teacher, who develops local literacy and numeracy games and plays them intergenerationally, often in the countries it's been evaluated. It's across five countries, big boosts in literacy scores, but also something else. The kids are developing some of the skills that Val talked about, teamwork, collaboration, working with each other, having a dialogue across different members in their community. So that's one example. And we argue that for leapfrogging, we really need to do the types of things that LIMA does more often, which is diversifying the people and places where learning takes place. Sometimes innovations are schools themselves. This is an example from Brazil. NAVE schools, there are several of them, are technical and vocational schools, and they have really transformed how teaching and learning is done to, yes, certainly have direct instruction, but to make space for what we are often calling playful learning pedagogies, because it incorporates a whole bunch of different student-centered pedagogies that includes iteration, experimentation, working with teams. And these schools are, again, not traditional academic high schools. They're high schools. They're vocational technical schools focused on digital skills for the new economy. They learn their high school subjects. So, for example, in biology class, they would work together in groups to develop a game, a digital game for how the circulatory system works, etc. And lo and behold, these schools beat out all their academic high schools for top scores in their respective states on the secondary leaving exams. But not only did they really have good learning in academics, they had all sorts of other skills and competencies too. And we think that idea of being able to accomplish both at the same time is really crucial for leapfrogging. Another example comes from South Africa. And this is an example of partnerships with employers that really transform how student learning is assessed and recognized. These are high schools that serve very marginalized poor kids. But at the end of the high school, the students have a learning experience where they spend a year within a company. And the employers, yes, they look at their academic scores, but the employers and the teachers work with the kids and mentor them as they're working on projects in the company, and really assess them based not just on their academic exams, but on what kind of people they are. Are they able to be flexible to work with others? And then the employers decide if they want to hire these folks. And 80% of the kids in the program get their higher education paid for by the employers and then go back to working with the employers, which is far surpasses the average rate of that type of accomplishment in South Africa. Only about a third of high school students in South Africa even get an exam mark in high school that will allow them to go on to higher education. So that's that idea of innovating around how you assess and recognize learning, we also think is important for leapfrogging. Here's another example. Sometimes it's not nonprofits, sometimes it's not particular schools, sometimes it's the government who's trying to transform whole education systems. This is an example, again, from Brazil called the Media Lab. A couple of years ago, the Brazilian national government passed a law saying all children in Brazil must be able to go to primary and secondary school. In Amazonas State, very rural, part of the Amazon jungle, most kids were just accessing primary school. And the central government, you know, set out basic standards of what's required in terms of children's rights, and then crucially gave flexibility to the leaders to figure out how to best meet those standards. So the Secretary of Education of Amazonas State got creative. He took the teachers, broke them into two types of teachers, lecturing teachers and tutoring teachers, and basically had content instructors and lecturing teachers broadcast with two-way video uplink to 1,000 little classrooms at a time. And the tutoring teachers did all those other things that teachers have to do during the day besides from delivering lessons, classroom management, supporting kids, etc. And it's worked very well. Quick jump in the number of kids who are able to access secondary school. And lastly, sometimes innovations are platforms. EduCurious, we'll hear from Vicky later in the day about this innovation, is a platform that really supports schools, public schools in the U.S. with serving marginalized kids, to help train teachers and support teachers and develop their capacity to deliver project-based learning methodologies for their kids. It also reaches outside of the schools and taps experts. They have an expert network and brings in sort of mentors to both work on projects with kids and build that social capital that marginalized kids often really need to thrive in their post-schooling life, but don't often get a chance to develop. So those are just some examples. That's really a tip of the iceberg. There's many, many different types of education innovations, but they reflect, I think, some of the big trends that we saw when we looked across the global catalog. 60% of the education innovations are focused on the most marginalized kids, as are virtually all of the innovations I just told you about, really reaching those who are left behind, which I think is part of the promise of leapfrogging. Half of the innovations in the catalog use edtech in any meaningful way, and half don't. So there's a mix. Technology and innovation are not synonymous. Half of the innovations try to do what we talked about in the example of Nave from Brazil, rigorous academic skill development as well as 21st century skills at the same time. 60% of the innovations are led by nonprofits. Nonprofits are really the engine of education innovation in the global education community. Interestingly, and I think, Emiliana, maybe we will come back to this in the discussion, the example of Amazonas State from Brazil, where an education system is innovating and transforming and leapfrogging, are far and few between. And maybe we just missed them. It could be that they're out there and our methodology didn't capture them. But only 12% of the innovations in the catalog were led by governments. And so that's a question. How do we think about education innovation? Education really is innovative, but maybe most of these innovations are still on the margins of education systems and not yet at the center of an education system. So after studying this for a while, we thought, well, where does that leave us? How is all this information about education innovation going to help us leapfrog? And really, we realized we have to figure out where are we trying to leapfrog to? Because just because something is innovative doesn't necessarily mean it's good. And it really depends on what our goal is for education, because some innovations are going to help us more than others to get there. And I'm sure if we did a little poll in this room, we would have many different ways of answering this question. What is the goal or purpose of education? Some people say it's to get good jobs. Some people say it's to improve people's lives. Some people say it's to develop citizens and leaders for the common good, etc. So part of what we did is step back and think, what are the big issues that most education systems are grappling with that leapfrogging will need to address? And we came up with the twin problems in global education. For this, we built a lot on our joint work with contributing to the International Education Commission. And we basically have boiled it down to two things. Most countries, not every country, but most countries are grappling with skills inequality and skills uncertainty. On this side, skills inequality, it's hard to see, that gray is very difficult, but this is basically the fact that most education systems do not deliver education services equally to their wealthy children and their poor children. And that we need to make sure that every kid can get the benefit of what today's education system has on offer. The Education Commission estimates that by 2030, half of the youth population in the developing world, low and middle income countries, will not have the basic secondary skills they need to thrive. So basic literacy, very basic numeracy, basic critical thinking and problem solving. That is half of the entire youth population. And the pace of change, if we don't do anything different, is quite slow. It could take decades, could take a century to change that with the current pace of change. So that's skills inequality. And while education systems are grappling with that, all education systems have to think about and reorient themselves to the types of questions that Val posed. How do you prepare young people for an increasingly uncertain future in a world where it's unclear what the jobs are, where problems are increasingly complex, where there is fake news of all types. It's hard to decipher what is what. And just an example from the Future of Work studies, most jobs will have some form of tasks automated. So in your daily job, the things you do every day, routine cognitive and routine manual tasks will be automated. This is a study that estimates between 50 and 70% of tasks within jobs will be automated. So we're going to be asking young people as they enter the world of work to do very different things on a daily basis. So again, those are our two big problems that most countries face. And so therefore, our ultimate decision and frame, at least for us, for leapfrogging, is to say, look, it's what we want to do is leapfrog in a way that addresses both skills inequality and skills uncertainty. And for that, you need this breadth of skills, the skills, again, that Val was talking about, academic plus 21st century. And when we talk about skills, we're talking about capabilities and competencies. And what you need is young people to not only learn knowledge and information, which most education systems are well set up to do, but you need them to be able to have the competencies and abilities to manipulate and use that information in different contexts over the course of their life. We need to start educating lifelong learners. That is really what we say, at least, the goal of leapfrogging should be. So, how to do that? How do we leapfrog? We ultimately said, you know, what we think you need to do in order to leapfrog is you have to transform what and how children learn. Now, I want to pause on this for a moment because education is different from other sectors in various ways. And in other sectors, often you just jettison and throw out the legacy system. We're not using landlines very much anymore. We're using mobile phones. In education, what would it mean to jettison the legacy system? It'd basically be eliminating schools. Schools are the legacy system. We do not think that is a useful and productive way to go. The idea of mass education in and of itself is relatively new historically. The idea that every kid should be educated and has a right to be educated is an exercise in radical social equality, actually. And it actually has benefited society. Better health, better wealth, many, many things can be tied to the spread of mass education. And so with that caveat, what we say is we don't want to throw out schools, but we want to change how schools think about tackling their job. Traditionally, most schools and mass education has expanded by first focusing on access, get kids into school. That's what I got to do. Then once they're in school, focus on, you know, are they learning academically? And then focus after that, well, are the things they're learning relevant to their lives? And that's how education in the U.S. expanded, if you look historically. It's how education in the developing world has traditionally expanded, if you look at the legacy of the Millennium Development Goals. And we argue that to leapfrog, you need to do all three at the same time. And people will say, it's too hard, it can't be done, you're asking us to run before we can walk. And the benefit of being at a think tank where you don't have to implement anything is to say, well, you should try. So we spent a lot of time scanning the landscape of existing evidence around what data says about transforming what and how children learn. And we came up with this leapfrog pathway. This is a very short synthesized summary version, but I'll just talk you through it briefly and we'll go through each element one by one. The two blue elements at the top are core elements. We think both of these are really needed in order to leapfrog to a place where all kids can develop a full breadth of skills. You need to transform teaching and learning so it's more student-centered, and you need to, alongside that, transform how that teaching and learning is recognized, how you assess, how you progress, and verify that what kids' skills are. Underneath that, the green and the yellow are support elements. These are things that we think, given the scope and scale of the education challenge, are really important to leverage, but are not absolutely necessary in every given context. You need to diversify people and places. You need to increasingly use data in a way that's results-oriented. This is what the real leapfrog pathway looks like, and I will spare you going through every little box one by one, and give you sort of the highlights from each. But I mainly am showing you to make the point that we set out a continuum. There's steps along the way, destinations along the way, because, of course, leapfrogging very much depends on the context from which you are starting. So let's go through teaching and learning. So some of our arguments in teaching and learning is that we need to make room for playful learning pedagogies, that type of iterative, experimental, teamwork pedagogies, in addition to direct instruction, et cetera, that allows children to not only memorize and remember information, but also to be able to analyze, evaluate, and create information themselves. And that's really the transformation we're looking at for teaching and learning. In terms of what all the innovations that we studied are doing vis-a-vis that, a whole bunch of them, almost 70%, are employing playful learning pedagogies. And this is interesting. This is the part, and part of why we have started to have a panel later today on teacher training, but only 9% of them are actually working to support and develop teachers' own competencies and abilities to deploy those playful learning pedagogies. So what is that disjuncture about? We will talk more about that with Jenny Anderson and the panelists. Secondly, recognition of learning. Again, this is about how you assess and progress students and verify. And remember the example of Gopher Gold, where the employers looked at exam results, yes, but they also had other ways of recognizing learning. Not very many folks in the global catalog are innovating in this area. 15% of the innovations are really focusing on much more individualized progression, only 2% doing the types of things that the Go for Gold program did. People and places. This is the example of adding to, like Lima adds to, a licensed teacher in a classroom, adding to their ability to help children learn by bringing in different experts, different tools to help with the learning process. Again, Lima did this with the board games. EduCurious does this with the expert network. In some ways, the Media Lab in Brazil did this by splitting the teaching profession into two. And a lot of people, Education Innovations, are working on what we call unburdening teachers. So really trying to help take away some of the tasks that teachers have to do, or do them in a way that's much more creative and helps elevate teachers so they can focus on the instruction they need to do. And this includes things like tools that automate administrative tasks, which we know teachers are all around the world are burdened by. It includes crowding in expert community help from the examples I gave earlier. It includes splitting the changing the different roles of teachers, etc. And we will have a discussion about this with Greg right after this session. The other piece around technology and data, we used the SAMR model, which those of you, I'm sure Hadi, in the EdTech space is quite familiar with, and others who work in this space are quite familiar with. It's substitution, augmentation, modification, and redefinition, which is, and we argue that educational technology that just substitutes for an analog function or augments what an analog function is already doing could be fine, could be good, but is not going to transform what and how to kids learn. What you want is educational technology that modifies or redefines what's possible, like in the case of the Media Lab, totally redefining what was possible in Brazil. Only 20% of the education innovations that we studied really used technology in a way that modified or redefined what was possible. So, in conclusion, we are optimistic about the potential to leapfrog. There is a need absolutely to think very carefully about the teaching and learning process, and particularly the enabling environment, about how to scale some of these innovations and bring them from the margins to the center. Thank you very much.
Can you hear me?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yes. Well, thank you both, Rebecca and Valerie, for your rich remarks. There's a lot of content to go through. Before I kind of entice conversation, I want to apologize for the translators for us, because leapfrogging in Spanish is impossible to translate. So I'm sure, I don't know how they're doing it, but I wish we had a similar word in our language. In any case, we've heard from both of you about the importance of orienting education systems to develop citizens of the future. And today we will be exploring in-depth innovative approaches to unburdening and training teachers. Where do you see teachers' most important role if education's goal is to help develop citizens of the future? Let me start with you, Val.
Thank you. So as I suggested in my remarks, I believe that the most important role teachers can play at any level of education. I focus my remarks on higher education, but I think certainly with earlier students at earlier ages as well, is to encourage in them the habit of active engagement with ideas, active engagement in their learning, what I refer to as critical thinking. And I think that that the groundwork for that kind of active engagement, where students are encouraged to question and to participate in actively in their learning, not only to receive knowledge and information, is something that we can and should be encouraging teachers to do from the earliest ages. I think this is part of what goes into helping young people grow into lifelong, the role of lifelong learner. So I think that's the most important thing. But I also hasten to say that that teachers at all levels would benefit from support and encouragement to figure out how to develop that capacity and expand it over the course of their careers.
And just to follow up, Val, before I go to Rebecca, given that you've been in higher education most of your career, we know that it should start in teacher preparation programs. So teachers, as students, being, mm-hmm. you know, having the experience of being able to question and be curious mm-hmm. and try new things. And do you see that evolving, in at least in the U.S., where you're more familiar? And how hard is it to do that in higher education?
I think it's very hard. I mean, I think it's evolving to some degree, but I don't think it's evolving quickly enough. I think in this country, and sort of more generally, it seems to me that we can and must do better to incentivize this kind of approach for teachers. I think that the teachers across K through 12, or and even before the kindergarten years, face an extraordinary number of pressures to serve many different capacities and needs that their students face, and they are not always receiving the support they need, even if they've gotten that sort of preparation as they mm-hmm. train to become teachers. I think to be able to continue that work beyond that is not as easy as it should be.
Certainly, mm-hmm. and it's also hard in developing countries, mm-hmm. even more so. Mm-hmm. Let me go to Rebecca, and you know, you mentioned the fact that few innovations come from the public sector, and mm-hmm. I was very happy to see the innovation that you highlighted, the media center from Amazonas, because actually we're supporting that with a loan. So it's
well done.
Yeah, very exciting that they actually, you know, wanted to expand and needed additional resources. And at the time for us, it was also risky because right. we didn't know if it was working. Yeah. And now we have evidence that it is, in fact, working. But we have a lot of government officials in the audience. And can you tell us how you think the respective roles of government, the private sector, and civil society can work together for educating our students and the citizens of the future?
Right. Well, I find that sometimes when I talk to people, the word innovation in education, people automatically think about the private sector. And I do think the private sector has an important role to play. But at the end of the day, it has to be the government who is responsible for creating the enabling environment for education to take place. And they have to drive the education transformation. Nonprofit sector and the private sector have different motivations, and neither of them really have sort of the duty and the responsibility to take care of every single kid in that country. And so often what we talk about, and we've done this with my colleague Jenny Perlman Robinson and our Millions Learning Research, is that really what we want is a flexible and adaptive education ecosystem where the government is at the center. And again, I like the Brazil example. It sets out big policies. These are the children's rights to education. And then it allows flexibility in how you get there, of course, with regulation and oversight. You don't just, you know, let anybody do whatever. And in that type of context, I think that partnership with the private sector and nonprofits is really important. We saw that a number of the innovations were partnering, particularly the ones that scaled much more quickly were partnering in some way or shape or form. The government was partnering with private sector or nonprofits.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
I wonder if I might just add something. As I was listening to your remarks during your presentation and even just now, I was so happy to hear you talk about the importance of partnerships across these various sectors. In the example from the program at Swarthmore that I talked about, what makes that program successful is the fact that it depends upon partnerships that involve faculty, but also, as I mentioned, neighbors and other staff members from across the college. What's so important to me about that, the idea of partnership, is that it indicates that the responsibility for education is really shared, ultimately, and that it relies upon a sort of distribution of responsibility across various sectors. And to the extent that we are thinking about the future of our global community, I value the opportunity to create opportunities for students to be able to learn from many different places and sites.
Absolutely. And, you know, in the two presentations, and particularly in Rebecca's, we kind of hear three words that are constantly present when we're talking about citizens of the future, leapfrogging, innovation, and technology. Are these three inseparable? Can we think about leapfrogging without technology? Can we think innovation without technology? So how do we advance and clearly reach our goal of citizens of the future, and do we need all three? I guess that's my question.
Do you want to go first, Val?
I'd like you to take that.
So we thought actually a lot about this and got into some heated arguments with folks who work in the ed tech space who have, I mean, good colleagues, good debates, saying, you know, there's no way, their argument was there's no way you can scale education transformation without technology. Mm-hmm. And our argument was, well, maybe, but you also have education systems in places where they don't rely heavily on technology and they have really good policy. And I think about Finland as an example. And they're absolutely innovating and doing all sorts of interesting things, and we'll hear about that from Saku later in the day. It doesn't have to be present. I think, you know, half of the innovations in our catalog used EdTech in a meaningful way. I think where we see EdTech being transformative, it's really about reaching the most marginalized kids faster and quicker in ways where governments are poorly serving them. Mm-hmm. Now, you could have governments transform themselves and serve them better. That seems to be a long slog. So, I mean, I think you should try both, frankly, and see where you get to.
Mm-hmm. Do you have anything to say, Ash?
I'm trying to. I think about this. I would be reluctant to say that you cannot distinguish these three categories from themselves. I guess partly because I think the space of innovation needs to be able to be open to lots of different possibilities. And I guess I'm trying to figure out where and I think my concluding remarks sort of raise questions about this, because part of me is also thinking about the extent to which innovation is required to help enrich the human dimensions of educational innovation and the creation of opportunities. And so I just sort of want to always be thinking about where the human dimension, the human contact sort of fits mm-hmm. into all of this, and to make sure that we are not leapfrogging the benefits of those individual, more intimate relationships as we think about innovation for the future.
That's a very good point. Let me just ask Rebecca to tell us if you have next steps on your leapfrog research before I want to take some questions from the audience too.
Yeah. So yes, we do. We are primarily thinking about three things. One is part of sort of the dissemination of the book, and we have this global catalog up online, although it's not very searchable and it's not very helpful. So if people, we often get requests, and if anybody has a request, people say, can you tell me in sub-Saharan Africa all the ed tech innovations? So we will start pulling that for people and putting it online. So please send us your requests. That's a small one. The second big one is to really do a deep dive into the teaching, the first pillar of the leapfrog pathway, teaching and learning. And really, you know, thinking a lot about teachers and teaching. Why is it that so few innovations are tackling teacher training and development? What are the effective, playful learning innovations? And then thirdly, is to look at the enabling environment. We're particularly interested in the demand side of education and leapfrogging. We did 100 interviews with 100 thought leaders for the book, and all of them had examples of, from ministers of education on down to classroom teachers, had examples of trying to do innovative, very leapfroggy things, and parents pushing back in one way or another. So we're particularly interested in learning a lot more about the demand side. And, you know, if we could all leapfrog, would parents and students be ready? And maybe that's separate. Maybe students would be ready and parents wouldn't, or who knows? We'll see. But we'd love to hear any of your thoughts also or experiences you have in relation to that demand side.
And before I go to questions from the audience, I want to mention that the IDB is collaborating on a new innovation and research laboratory for Latin America and the Caribbean. And we have a webpage that I invite you to see. It's called SUMMA, S-U-M-M-A, edu.org. And there you can find a very actually user-friendly website with what is the international experience on what works in education adapted to Latin America and the Caribbean and in three languages, but also the 50 innovations around the world that have been evaluated and shown some evidence of impact with guides as to how you could actually adapt them and implement them. So I highly recommend that. And now let me take questions from the audience. We'll start from the back. Is there someone with a mic? Yeah.
I'm sure mics are coming, but I don't know where they are.
We'll see if I can talk.
Yeah. Oh, 1 second. No, the interpreters
need
you.
We need mics.
And also the one.
Mics to the room. Is anybody out there? I bet you someone's watching on a screen. Tyler, can you run some mics? Okay, here we are. There we are. They've arrived.
I think it's on,
Steve. Yeah.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yeah. Do you mind introducing yourself and naming, your institution briefly, and then go ahead.
Steve Cleese, University of Maryland.
I'm not sure.
It's not working.
It's definitely not on.
Steve Cleese, University of Maryland. Maybe this is mostly for Rebecca, but also for Val. You're using skills as the goal, and skills has a narrow interpretation too often of workplace skills.
Yeah.
I'm sure you're using it more broadly than that. But the question of innovation that changes attitudes, personal development, moral development, the broader purposes of education. So I guess my question is, what are you not including in the term skills? And shouldn't there be innovation for other parts of education?
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Want me to answer? Actually, Steve, I'm really glad you brought that up, because one of the things that I've noticed is, particularly for the Americans and the U.S. audience, the term breadth of skills, which seems to work much better overseas, is interpreted narrowly. So thank you for the question. What we really do mean, and this came out of some of the work we've done in the past with colleagues with UNESCO on the Learning Metrics Task Force and looking at the broad areas and domains of competencies that young people need to develop, is that full sort of broad suite of competencies and capabilities and skills that young people need. So I think it would probably include the broader vision that you're talking about, Steve. I don't know, Val.
Right. I would like to add just a few things about that, because I think, as my colleagues and I reflect on what it means to prepare students for their lives as citizens, I think that is over and above preparing them for their career path. And I think it's also about, the focus on how one lives in community, how one operates as a political subject in the world, takes responsibility for one sort of civic role. I mean, I think sort of all of these dimensions have to come into play. And I think, it's complicated in an academic environment where we are so often measured by the salaries that our alumni make, the first job out, and that kind of thing, and where students and their families are really focused on what will I do, how will I support myself, my family, repay debt, so on, right? But I think that, and I think also, it is not, in fact, the case that many of our faculty colleagues feel that they are equipped to support students and others through this, through a broader, more sort of expansive vision of what education means, or the relationship between extracurricular and co-curricular experience. But I do think it's part of our responsibility, and I think this is where the innovation part for us comes into play, is trying to figure out with whom we might consult how to learn together, take on the posture of a certain kind of humility to learn together what goals we need to be setting for future generations. But I think part of it is about how do people build a life within a community, not just build a career path.
Right. Let me go back there to the lady with the blue shirt. Yes.
Hi, my name is Sucheta. I'm from India. I represent an organization called Dream a Dream. So my question, I'm wondering, you started by somewhere, Rebecca, you said that there are more children in school today than ever before. And this is even true in India, where even with such a large population, we have almost 97% of children enrolled in school. So then I wonder, why is there a resistance to change? Why are innovations on the margin? And I have some idea about India, but I would love to hear your thoughts around what do you think is globally the reason that leapfrogging is still on the margins and not become mainstream?
I think that this will be a question we should discuss throughout the day, and I'm sure you have your own experiences. But I think there's something with this idea of you must do access first, and then quality, and then relevance. I think this is dominant logic. That is powerful, and it makes a certain amount of sense too. I mean, like, kids aren't in school, get them into school first. That's first and foremost. But we did a lot of review of the innovations literature that largely sits, frankly, in the outside of education, often in the business community. And one of the things they talk about for innovations to really break through and succeed is having to sort of identify what the dominant logic is, and that mental models, in some ways, are stronger barriers to transformation than legal models or legislative environments or policy. And so I think that idea of mindset shift is actually really, really important. And something that, why we put this work out there. We want everyone to, if I could have one thing, is for you guys to go back to your work and have the idea of leapfrogging in the back of your mind and think about your work differently, perhaps.
Let's go back to the right and the lady here. And we'll keep switching right and left.
Hello, my name is Evgenia Peva, and I come from an organization called Teachro Bulgaria, part of the Global Teachro Network. I'm very excited to be here with you today and learn about Latin America, the United States, and hopefully also a little bit more about Asia and other parts of the world. I want to build on that question that was just asked. Leapfrogging, as we heard, comes 60% from nonprofits. The other parts maybe come from some business and some policy. Makers. I want to understand what could be mechanisms to help, especially the public sector, which Rebecca rightly mentioned, is the key holder of scaling those innovations. What can they learn from your research, and what are some aspects of their work that could change, or what are some levers we could introduce in our collaboration with them so that these innovations are scaled more effectively? Thank you.
Do you want to
tackle?
Okay. if you have any other comments. Okay, so one of the things that I think is helpful is for governments to think about how can you rapidly help marginalized kids get this breadth of skills, or Steve might be happier with breadth of sort of learning opportunities or sets of competencies. Often we think about, for the most marginalized kids, government policy is really just, get them the basics. And I think if anything that I've learned over scanning all these innovations is there's lots of creative ways that you can, if you have an out-of-school kid, they can have a 21st century education. It might look different. It might not be with, totally within the same type of model that other kids are getting the education, but they can have it. A mix of technology, a mix of creative teaching, a mix of teachers who care about them, who can bring in other sets of expertise. It is possible. And I don't think we're doing any favors to say, poor kids first need to, get in school and learn to read and write. And that's sort of the floor. I think we're not doing them any favors. I think they will learn better and progress better if you try to be a little more ambitious. So that might be my number one recommendation.
So I see someone who's in government who wants to pitch in. So I'd like to invite Miguel Bresner to give your view of how governments can innovate.
No, my question was, if we can discuss a lot about how government should innovate, and I think it's part of the day-to-day. One of the differences is we talk a lot about innovation, and I consider that in the public sector, innovation is only innovation if it's scalable. And some of the solutions we've seen and we hear all over the world are very micro innovations, and they're not scalable on the public sector because you have 80 million, 100 million, 1,000 million, 3 million in Uruguay, right? So I wanted to, if you can share, what's your idea on innovation? Because I remind, leapfrog, your question, leapfrog innovation is very interesting, but there is a lot of innovation without technology, there is a lot of technology with innovation, and there is a lot of technology that's back on the 19th century. So my concern is that about innovation, and the other one is, in a system model that's on the second industrial revolution, the solutions cannot be a modification of that. Have to be something different in the minds. So that's open for discussion, but I wanted to hear your opinions.
Well, everybody should go see Miguel's conversation at lunchtime if they want to hear how Uruguay really, the public sector, did some transformation of education from the government-led. So you will have a lot to say about this equally as I, Miguel. But it's an interesting question. We debated this idea of, are we going to scan the globe for education innovations and really just look at those that have rigorous randomized controlled trials for effectiveness and or are proven to be scalable on sort of across a large number of students. And we debated internally, and at the end of the day, we decided, no, we're not going to do that. We're going to define innovation, like we said, you know, an idea or technology that breaks with current practice in a context, if it's new there, not necessarily new to the world, because part of what we wanted to do was see what's on the horizon, what's coming down the pike, what is happening that might be just micro at the moment, but has the potential maybe in 10 years to really transform how we think about education. And you're not going to capture the innovations that are just sort of emerging and perhaps the most cutting edge if you require some of, you know, broad scalability or broad sort of very, very rigorous evaluation. So we have a full mix. I mean, some of the innovations in the catalog reach 150 million learners, so really, really big. And some of them are teeny tiny. They reach 150 learners. So that's part of the reason we did that. I do think that, again, part of the next steps and part of our challenge collectively as an education community is to try to think about what innovations are most promising for the public sector to take on. How could we sort that? How could we help policymakers make their own decisions and decide, you know, what are most relevant for them? So that's part of what we're interested in exploring with this enabling environment work.
And I just wanted to, I guess, maybe respond as well from the vantage point as my vantage point as leader of a very small liberal arts college tucked away in suburban Philadelphia, in the suburban Philadelphia area. I mean, we often ask ourselves about the question of scalability. I mean, we feel that we are, in some ways, I mean, sort of trying to shape lives one life at a time. But part of the mission of the institution by inspiring our alumni to think about the impact they can have on the world is that I think we realize that there's something profoundly optimistic in this model. We feel that the individual lives we touch are inspired to try to become innovators in whatever sphere in which they find their life calling, and so that these individual lives actually have the potential to have broader impact. That's one. And secondly, as we attract an increasingly global community of students, I mean, we're finding that our alumni are being able to have a broader impact across the globe. But I think institutions like Swarthmore and other smaller institutions like our own, we do recognize that there are some concerns about the scalability of this model and of its optimism.
So I see a lot of hands still, and I'm very sorry that our time has come up. I want to thank Val and Rebecca for their excellent remarks and now this conversation. We have a very full day ahead, and as you will see from the agenda that hopefully you picked up at the entrance, we have next a terrific panel on unburdening teachers. As I mentioned earlier, there are headsets underneath your seats for simultaneous translation. The next session will feature a Spanish speaker, so please, for those of you who don't understand and speak Spanish, you will need to have your headset, and channel 2, I believe, is for translation into English. Following that next session, we're going to move into lunch for 4 simultaneous discussions diving into questions around EdTech. Please take a look at your packet and for a short write-up for each of the sessions, and make sure you select because they're on a first-come, first-serve session. Later in the day, we'll hear from innovators themselves. This will be also a simultaneous session. You can find more details about it in your packet. We are excited to have innovation spotters here, those showcasing and highlighting innovations to better understand how innovations work on the ground. So please, you know, save time for them. And finally, we will close the day with a chance to network with each other and the showcased innovators over wine and cheese. There will be quite a bit of moving around today from rooms, so please be sure to keep an eye on your belongings and take them with you anytime you change rooms. We also ask that you put your interpretation headsets back on your chairs when you leave any room. And now I would like to welcome Jane Demian Ehrenfeld to the stage. Jane is the Executive Director of the Center for Inspired Teaching and is going to lead a short activity to get us moving before the next session. Jane, thank you. Thank you.
Good morning, everyone. Can you hear me? Before I start, Daniel Wagner, if you are here and you are watching, you have lost your wallet, and it is at the front desk waiting for you. So, what? Is that on? Nope. Okay. So, my name's Jane. I'm from Center for Inspired Teaching here in Washington, D.C. All of you saw there was a pretty shocking statistic up there earlier, several shocking statistics, but one of which was that while 69% of innovations out there in education involve playful learning, only 9% actually teach teachers how to make their classrooms playful spaces. So at Center for Inspired Teaching, we are all about focusing on the teacher as the lever for change and teaching them to create classrooms that are authentically engaging and joyful and playful and fun for their students. So someone at Brookings, I won't say who, had the idea to have me come up here and help engage you in the kinds of activities that we do with teachers when we're working with them. And so we're gonna get our blood flowing, we're gonna get our neurons firing a little bit, and hopefully there'll be a little bit of laughter too, because I think that's kind of a radical proposition in education, that classrooms can be fun and happy and joyful places. So you can do this in any language, this activity, so whatever language is most comfortable for you, all it requires is being able to count backwards from 10. Good? Those of you following along at home, please join in. So I'm going to ask everyone to stand up. You can put everything just on your seat. Okay. Right hands up. Okay. We're going to count backwards from 10 and shake our hands. Ready? 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Right foot, 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Left foot, 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Sorry, ladies in high heels. 9, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Thank you. Okay. Yeah. Now we're going to get the neurons going a little bit. So you're going to need a partner for this. If there's three of you, that's absolutely fine. So what you're going to do, I'm going to stand over here so I can be on the microphone, but also you can hear me. So one of you is going to take your hands, left hand over right. You're going to kind of flip them around to the so your thumbs are facing down. So left hand over right, flip your hands, and lace your fingers. Pull them through. Okay, everybody, you got me? So left hand over right, flip your hands around, lace your fingers, and pull them through. Great. Now, here's the key. Your partner cannot touch you. Very important. Partners, point at one of the fingers that your partner has laced. So only one person should have their hands like this right now. Point at one of the fingers and ask your partner to move that finger. Don't touch. If you touch, it ruins it. If you touch, it ruins it. As moving a finger can suddenly become really, really, really hard in the wrong context. And sometimes it's as easy as just moving your fingers. So just a little activity to get you thinking in a new direction as we move into our next panel. Thank you. I will be back a little later for some more fun. Some of you might want to plan your coffee breaks around the next time I come to the stage. So the next section focuses on unburdening teachers. As you heard before, one of the panelists will be speaking in Spanish, so please use your headpieces. Channel 2 is for English, channel 10 is for Spanish. Colleagues in the overflow rooms are watching via webcast. You will hear it in English translated directly. Will the panelists for the next session please come to the stage? Greg, Allison, Hadi, Manolo, and David. Thank you.